Today at Reader's Corner, Joe Nocera, co-author with Bethany McLean of The Big Fail, What the Pandemic Revealed About Who America Protects and Who It Leaves Behind. I'm Bob Custrom. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Joe Nocera is an op-ed columnist for the Free Press. His previous books include A Piece of the Action and All of the Devils Are Here, co-written with Bethany McLean. He's won 3 Gerald Loeb Awards for Excellence in Business Journalism and was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize in 2006. Joe Nocera, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Nice to be here, Bob.
Well, Joe, I hazard a guess that most Americans have the pandemic in their rearview mirror and don't really want to sit around thinking about what went right and what went wrong during that time. But you and your co-author, Bethany McLean, think otherwise. And maybe we should start at the beginning. Why revisit the pandemic now?
Well, first of all, because it's probably not going to be the last one. Second of all, because it showed a lot of things about our society that we really need to look at clearly, which were kind of shrouded, that the pandemic had the effect of putting a spotlight on certain aspects of society. And then the measures that we took to try and beat back the pandemic, we need to be more honest about what they did and whether they worked and what the effect of political polarization was on what should have been a healthcare issue.
And let's talk a little bit about the government officials and the scientists who were active in this period. Part of your story is how poorly they performed. Remind us of how Dr. Fauci, for example, originally told the story of the pandemic by using the 1918 model, which really didn't apply much to the coronavirus, did it?
That's pretty, you pretty much nailed it there, Bob. I guess you must have read my book. In 1918, the pandemic was an influenza pandemic, a flu pandemic, just a really, really nasty virus. But it was so nasty that it was pretty indiscriminate about who it killed and how it killed. So 30-year-old men, children, the elderly, they were all vulnerable to the influenza pandemic. And not surprisingly, the pandemic plans the government came up with, especially after George W. Bush read a famous book about the great influenza and demanded that we come up with a plan, was built around the idea of the next virus would be an influenza virus. Well, the coronavirus was completely different. It killed, but it didn't kill as indiscriminately as influenza. That's number one. Mm-hmm. It killed the elderly vastly, geometrically more than it killed middle-aged people, and even more geometrically, if there's such a phrase, to children who, you know, were largely unscathed by the pandemic. And so to take one issue that really stands out above all others, in my opinion, you know, we closed the schools. Most of the country closed the schools in March and April of 2020 and all through the rest of that semester. And we did it to save the lives of children and to prevent children from being sick. But the fact of the matter is that schools were probably the best place children could be. Because they tended not to transmit to each other and because they tended, you know, they just didn't get as sick as the elderly or, you know, so, you know, the damage in the end, schools, many of the big city public school systems stayed closed well into 2021. And the bottom line is that the damage done to children, especially disadvantaged children, from being out of school for that length of time was far, far, far greater than any damage that would have been done by keeping kids in school and taking and facing the risk of getting COVID.
Now, if I'm a teacher listening to this comment, I might say, hey, what about me? What about me? What about teachers and staff? We were more than likely to get it, more likely to get it than children anyway. How do you answer that?
Well, I would say a couple of things. The first of all, I know this sounds strange, but studies consistently showed that teachers, that school systems, that schools that took proper precautions had a much lower rate of COVID disease than just being in your house or being, you know, out and about. I know that sounds weird, but like in New York, there was a moment when the rate of COVID went from 3% to 6%, and the rate of COVID in schools went from 0.20 for children, you know, and for the teachers, it was like 0.60. So it's still much less. But I would say this, you know, 20 and 30 and 40-year-old teachers were probably pretty safe. 50 and 60 and 70-year-old teachers were probably not that safe or less safe. But it wouldn't have been that hard to devise systems that would have protected the older teachers and had the younger teachers go to school. There is undoubtedly risk in life. But in my experience, whenever I would hear about a teacher that died of COVID and I'd say, well, how did they die? Where did they get it? They almost always got it at home or some other place other than school. I know that sounds unlikely, but that's the reality.
So Dr. Fauci predicts a COVID-19.
We're back to him already?
I want to go back to Dr. Fauci because I have great regard for Dr. Fauci, and he's been annihilated in some communities anyway. And I picked up in your book the section where he predicts the COVID-19 vaccine. In 12 to 18 months, he said, we can have this ready to go. There are many doubting Thomases who don't believe him. But as it turns out, he's right. And he's right because of something called messenger RNA. And I think the story of the scientist researcher who really fought an uphill battle in her own right is just something that people ought to know about. And I didn't know about it until I read your book. So why don't you clue us in on this young lady that figured this out?
Well, let's talk about Dr. Fauci first. He was absolutely right. He understood enough about messenger RNA to know that this was a development that had been in progress for 9 or 10 years. It had taken an incredibly long time to figure out how it worked and how to corral it for use. And when the virus came along, it was obvious to Moderna and Pfizer in particular that it could be adopted and adapted to a vaccine. And the fact of the matter is, they got the vaccine up and running really very quickly. The issue, what took a long time, was getting it, you know, approved by the FDA, which was, you know, very appropriate. You had to make sure that it wasn't going to, you know, that it was going to work. And then secondly, you had to get the manufacturing up and running. And that was much, much more complicated than just creating the vaccine. And that required the efforts of the federal government and what we now know as Operation Warp Speed. The woman who really developed mRNA with a colleague at the University of Pennsylvania, actually, she just won a Nobel Prize this year, was so doubted as she was going through this process that she was constantly giving crappier offices and less pay, and her efforts kind of scoffed at. She didn't have a big lab. She didn't have a lot of research assistants. And finally, she went with a company, BioNTech, and that is the company that joined forces with Pfizer to create their version of the vaccine. And it took a long time, but in the end, she has gotten the credit that she deserves. And as I said, she recently won a Nobel Prize.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Joe Nocera, co-author of The Big Fail, What the Pandemic Revealed About Who America Protects and Who It Leaves Behind. There was a meeting in late March at the Trump White House of high-profile CEOs from the manufacturing sector. And since you mentioned the manufacturing side of things when it comes to either the vaccine or PPE equipment, whatever, they were seeking a coordinated lead response by government since there was so much competition going on between the states and healthcare institutions, and people were bidding against each other. What did they get from the Trump White House at that time?
Nothing good. I mean, the Trump White House did acknowledge there was a problem. Most of the people in the White House, with the exception of the president, were trying to do something about it. But, you know, to your point, you had all these CEOs that are saying, we want to help our country. What can we do? They go to this meeting and Jared Kushner, you know, gets up and basically says, you know, this is going to solve itself. There's nothing for you to do. There's no effort at coordination. You know, these companies were willing to, you know, turn their empty factories into PPE factories and do other things that would have helped the country. And there just was no interest on the part of the government, which is really kind of unbelievable. You know, in terms of PPE itself, this gets to a different problem, an important problem, which is that, you know, in our rush to globalize everything, to outsource everything, to get everything cheaper, as cheap as possible, all the PPE that Americans used to make, whether it was gloves, whether it was masks, whether it was gowns or shoes, it had all been outsourced to China and some to Mexico and some to Vietnam. But basically, with the exception of 3M's N95 mask, everything else had been outsourced. So, you know, the pandemic comes along and suddenly there's a desperate need for masks. But the Chinese, even though they have contracts that say they're supposed to send it to Cardinal Health, they say, you know, we're an emergency. We need these masks ourselves. We're not going to give them to you. So suddenly America has a dire need for masks that they can't get. A black market develops. People are getting ripped off left and right. Hospitals are losing tons of money by putting up escrow that then just disappears. And it's just a monster disaster. And in the end, it's the canary in the coal mine, because when you think about it, towards the end of COVID, you had a giant shortage of all kinds of things. You had supply chain issues up and down corporate America. Couldn't get enough semiconductors for cars. Couldn't get enough medicines. You know, there are all kinds of shortages that are dire. And I think the PPE example really shows that the country needs to do a better job of making stuff itself so that this doesn't happen again.
Well, you've just identified the first of what you call three trends that made the collapse of medical supply chains and the overcapacity at have-not hospitals and the empty bed wealthy hospitals predictable. There were warnings, weren't there, Joe? I mean, there were people like Clyde Prestowitz and Dr. Michael Osterholm who saw this coming, but nobody
absolutely
did anything.
Absolutely. And the amazing thing to me was, all right, Osterholm goes on Oprah and he says if there's ever a pandemic, we're in big trouble because we're not going to have any equipment. And Mike Bowen, who runs a little PPE mask outfit in Texas, you know, he's badgering the federal government. He's saying, you know, this is going to be a problem. You really need to be ready for this. And he's just ignored. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, globalization, basically the book is divided into two parts when you come right down to it. One part is, you know, the 40 or 50 year trends in capitalism that really made things much, much worse than they needed to be. And the other part is the part about, you know, the lockdowns and school closings and the efforts America made, the states made, the federal government made to mitigate against COVID, most of which really failed.
Well, let's talk about the capitalism end of it. As a matter of fact, just a few weeks ago, we interviewed Brendan Belew, and he wrote a book called Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. I'd like you to focus on that second trend you mentioned, actually the second and the third. The second trend is the free market and its exemplar, I would call it, the HCA or the corporatization of healthcare in America. And then private equity firms. And how would a private equity firm come to play a role in the way we handled COVID? Well, I'll let you tell that story.
All right. Well, let me back up for 1 second. You know, I've been a capitalist my whole life. I've written about business for 45 years. You know, I'm not I'm not anti-business. I'm not some crazy progressive. Oops, I said that in Boise. That's going to cause me trouble. But I do believe and have long believed that there are some industries that should not be part of the free market system. And healthcare is at the very, very top of the list. And the reason is because there's an inherent conflict between taking care of patients and increasing profits. Now, in the case of private equity, they decided, private equity, you know, they operate like lemmings. If one firm or a couple of firms find a industry where they can make some money, they all dive in at once. So that's what you had with nursing homes. It happened in the early 2000s. Nursing homes were down and out. They were struggling. And so private equity decided they would dive in, figure out how to make money out of them. And everybody would live happily ever after. Well, what really happened was that private equity, what can they possibly offer a nursing home to make it run better? Nothing. The management techniques that they supposedly blah, blah, blah. None of that stuff is meaningless in terms of nursing homes. What nursing homes need are nurses and staff and proper care and enough people to take care of the patients and so on and so forth. Well, what's the first thing a private equity firm does when it buys a nursing home? The first thing it does is it sells the land under the nursing home to a real estate investment trust and puts that money in its pocket. And thus, the nursing home, which once owned its building and its land outright for free, now has to pay millions of dollars every year in rent. Then in buying the nursing home, of course, it usually goes into some debt. That debt goes on the books of the nursing home because that's how private equity operates. And so again, there's more debt that the nursing home or the nursing home chain has to pay. Well, now, how do you keep from going into too much trouble? You cut staff. You cut back on the things that the patients need. You cut back on the number of times a patient is visited in the course of the day by a staff aide. So when COVID comes along, the nursing home industry is completely ill-equipped to deal with it. They have the elderly patients who are the most vulnerable, right? And they have not enough staff who are just burned out very quickly. And it's a complete disaster. And if you look at the statistics, I haven't looked at them in a while, but if you look at the statistics, you will see that there are states where the majority of COVID deaths took place in nursing homes or among nursing home patients or staff. And that is an incredible black mark, in my opinion, on the private equity industry.
No doubt. So let's talk about the hospitals. There is a considerable difference in your book between the wealthy hospitals who had empty beds and the urban safety net hospitals and rural hospitals who were really, really challenged by this COVID. Now, you point to some bright lights. Chicago's Rush serves as an unusual model. Maybe you could share with us how that differs. And then San Francisco, a city you don't find getting a lot of accolades these days, in your book, serves as a model city on how to handle a pandemic. You can take it
right
from there.
both true. San Francisco first. San Francisco had by far the best numbers in COVID. It was a lockdown city, but even among other lockdown cities, its numbers were superior. And in my opinion, the reason it had much less to do with lockdowns and much more to do with the fact that they owned perhaps the country's largest nursing home in the city. In other words, it wasn't owned by private industry or private equity. It was owned by the city itself. It had something like 700 and some odd patients. It had plenty of staff. It knew exactly what to do when COVID came along. And to this day, or at least when we'd finished the book, something like 13 patients had died of COVID, which is an incredible statistic. The other thing they had, which most cities did not have, was the experience of AIDS. And because San Francisco had been so savaged by AIDS in the 1980s and 90s, there was a trust built up between the city public health system and the community that allowed the city to to go find the most vulnerable people, not just the elderly, but the disadvantaged, you know, people who lived in multi-generational households and so on, people who are the most likely to get COVID. And because they had that trust, they were able to protect those people a whole lot better than most other cities did. On the subject of the hospitals, yes, again, go back to my point about healthcare not being a really good model for capitalism, because, you know, you wonder why hospitals cost so much. Well, the answer is because they're trying to maximize shareholder value, and that means they have to try and raise prices every quarter. And they don't want Medicare patients, and they certainly don't want Medicaid patients. They just want patients who have insurance, and then they then, you know, bully the insurance companies to get the rates that they want. They also own, most emergency room doctors that you'll see in a hospital are not employed by the hospital, but they're employed by a private company, often a private equity company. So what that means is that the Medicaid patients, especially, are people with no insurance or people with substandard insurance. The big hospitals don't want them. They don't want to take them. They don't want to admit them. They want to send them to the safety net hospitals. And those are the hospitals, when you read in the paper about, you know, bodies being put in refrigerated trucks because they didn't have enough room, those are the hospitals that had to deal with all that. And as a general rule, and again, and you're right, Rush in Chicago is the exception to this, you know, under the law, hospitals are supposed to accept patients from other hospitals that are overflowing, but they usually find a way to refuse to do that. And so the safety net hospitals wound up with more patients than they could handle, COVID being spread left and right, while the private hospitals, yes, they had a rush in the beginning, but it wasn't too long before they were pretty empty. And they didn't have a whole lot to do while other hospitals were being overwhelmed with COVID. So yeah, that if you ask me, that's a big problem with our healthcare system.
And you do leave the reader with a bit of good news about recent efforts to take healthcare back from corporations and private equity firms, don't you?
Well, and beyond even what we do see some glimmers with doctors sort of organizing and saying, we're not going to take this anymore. But even after the book came out, there's been a lot of effort among, for instance, the FTC has begun an investigation into private equity's nursing home efforts. And so does the Senate has also started, and it's a bipartisan effort because, you know, it's not just Democrats who are pissed off at what happened during COVID. There are some Republicans who feel the same.
Today, I'm speaking with Joe Nocera, author of The Big Fail, co-authored by Bethany McLean. The book offers new answers for why and how America became the world leader in COVID deaths. So let's talk about lockdowns. And more specifically, I'd like you to comment on what happened to the meat packers and Amazon workers, just as an example of your subtitle, which is what the pandemic revealed about who America protects and who it leaves behind.
Let me say up front that I think the evidence is extremely clear that lockdowns, by and large, didn't work. But let's put that aside for a second. The issue in a country that is full of inequality, the pandemic exacerbated inequality in an overt and obvious way like almost nothing we've ever seen before. So here you had what I call the Zoom class, people like you and me, Bob, who could sit in our homes for months at a time, you know, use Zoom to have business meetings. You still get paid. You're ordering food from DoorDash. You're ordering goods from Amazon. Excuse me. You put your mask on to go get some meat. And meanwhile, you know, who's providing all these goods? Who's doing this? Well, it's the Amazon workers. And the meat packers had a huge number of COVID incidents, including quite a few deaths. And these were called, think about what a meat packer does. They're standing next to each other, chopping meat, you know, practically breathing on each other, even with masks. Amazon workers, Amazon refused to ever, you know, fess up on how many of their warehouse workers got COVID, but an awful lot of them did. And it was really scandalous. And it's really the reason why in Staten Island, for instance, they actually were able to, unionize, an Amazon warehouse. We read some things, from Houston in particular, where a reporter went down to UPS and FedEx to talk to the drivers there who were delivering all these goods. And they basically said, you know, we feel like we're being sacrificed so that the elites can survive. And, you know, that's a horrible thing. But most of the elites, including the liberal elites, never really thought about that. They thought about lockdowns as some virtuous thing they were doing to help everybody be safe. But really, they were only helping themselves. And in the scheme of things, when you look at how various states did and how various countries did, they weren't getting rid of COVID by hiding in their homes. They were simply delaying it.
No doubt. So, Joe, end of your book, you're writing this last chapter, and you're looking back over all that went wrong and a little bit that went right. And you're trying to figure out, well, let's see whether anybody has gotten this message. Let's see if there's some improvements. Let's see if there's some folks looking ahead instead of backwards. What are they going to find in that last chapter when you talk about staffing levels, national contract tracing, protocols? I mean, doesn't sound very optimistic when it comes to what is being done to get ready for the next one.
Yeah, ready for the next one. There's two things, I think, in particular. One is that we need a commission, bipartisan, that's willing to look at what worked and what didn't, and what we did right and what we did wrong, and how we can do it better. And you know, that sort of thing has really worked over the years in this country. I mean, remember the Challenger disaster and how the commission figured out what went wrong and how they right. had new protocols, and, you know, or remember after the financial crisis, there was a commission that ultimately led to new laws, that have been, you know, business doesn't like them, but they've been really quite helpful. So these sort of things can work, but we're in such a polarized world right now that if you had such a commission, they would just wind up squabbling about, you know, masks and lockdowns and did it work or didn't, and as opposed to trying to come up with some scientific basis for what works and what didn't, which never happened. So that's pretty discouraging, I would say. The other thing is, and this is something we really won't know until we actually have another public health emergency. I think the biggest problem with public health was they acted with certainty when there was no certainty. And they never were willing to say, we don't know, or this is a new virus and we're trying to figure it out. And, you know, they didn't act with humility. And as a result, when people realized that they were wrong about this or that, people lost faith. And they became distrustful of what public health officials said. And I think that was extremely damaging. And I think it bodes poorly for the next pandemic unless public health officials realize that they need to take a different stance and they need to be more honest with people about what we know and what we don't know.
Well, I can tell you right now that having lived in a very red state, it's mask wearing and vaccines that will be the controversies. Now, on the vaccine front, of course, that's partially due to Bobby Kennedy Jr. Working his way with the American public. But mask wearing is also going to be a very controversial matter to deal with the next time around.
And let me just say one thing about masks. The truth of the matter is that we don't really know whether masks work or not. Studies have been somewhat inconclusive, and it's a classic example where the red states take one position and the blue state citizens take another position, and science has not been able to figure this out. So it becomes a matter of your personal virtue and it becomes a matter of your personal values, whether you wear a mask or not, not whether it's going to save you or not. And you know, that's not a great thing.
Not even the N95s?
The N95s will work. But, Bob, you can't wear an N95 12 hours a day. You just can't. They take a lot of work to breathe in and breathe out. You're constantly aware you have them on your face. And human nature being what it is, people are not going to wear them in great numbers.
Mm-hmm. Joe Nocera, you've given us a lot to think about. Most importantly, you've given us a great book to read, and that is The Big Fail, What the Pandemic Revealed About Who America Protects and Who It Leaves Behind. It's Joe Nocera's book, along with Bethany McLean, his co-author. Thanks, Joe.
Bob, thanks a million for having me on. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.